The final investigator I met with was Dr. Herb Hurwitz, and while the main topic of our conversation was colorectal cancer, we began with pancreatic cancer and a landmark presentation he did at the last ASCO meeting of the use of the JAK1/2 inhibitor ruxolitinib. But before he discussed this fascinating data set, I asked him to address a more global issue commented on by Dr. O'Reilly, the relative clinical values of gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel versus FOLFIRINOX.
If you look at the two New England Journal reports, the patient demographics look fairly similar by the itemization in the tables, but we know that the FOLFIRINOX data were generated within one country, essentially France, and the gem nab-paclitaxel data were generated worldwide. Within that, if you just compare them side by side, which is always dangerous to make cross-study comparisons for exactly the reason that they're different populations, and even if the listed characteristics are the same, there may be other differences in the patients or their management that may affect outcomes. But with that caveat, I think there's a slight apparent superiority for FOLFIRINOX data compared to gem nab-paclitaxel data as it's reported. I think a head-to-head study would be great. It would certainly enable clinicians to make a more informed decision related to the trade-offs, and I hope someone would eventually conduct such a study. That said, I think the differences are probably fairly small in the outcomes. And also, I think that in general, for a good performance status patient, most patients will be able to get a second-line therapy. Not all, but probably more than half of good performance patients will be able to get a second-line therapy. And in that setting, often we'll use whatever was not used first with some adjustments either related to the dose intensity or the number of drugs used.
So does that mean in the people who get FOLFIRINOX, you usually use gem-nab next?
Yeah, perhaps with the first cycle being dose adjusted because of the amount of prior treatment from the FOLFIRINOX, but essentially, yeah.
And what about the reverse, the people who start out on gem-nab?
Yeah, in part because of sort of a minor discounting related to gem-nab being sort of considered the mama bear in the suite, I think for patients with really good performance status in second line, it'd be FOLFIRINOX or dose-adjusted FOLFIRINOX, or just probably FOLFOX alone.
So I'm really interested to hear your views on the data set you presented at ASCO looking at advanced pancreatic cancer and the very interesting combination of capecitabine and the JAK1/2 inhibitor ruxolitinib.
The background is that the trial was a so-called RECAP study, which was second, third-line patients who were treated with capecitabine plus or minus ruxolitinib or the placebo. The rationale for ruxolitinib is that drug is a JAK1/2 inhibitor. JAK1/2, the JAK kinases, serve as an intermediary in the signaling between multiple cytokine receptors and multiple inflammatory receptors, so IL-6, IL-1, as well as multiple other factors. And they in turn signal through the STAT system, particularly important for oncology being STAT3 and to a lesser degree STAT5. These things tend to drive high levels of IL-6, CRP, and multiple other inflammatory mediators. So there's a lot of biology in this area, which gets very complicated, and most of it hopefully is favorably aligned. One piece is that the inflammation causes a lot of issues like cachexia, anorexia, hypercoagulability. So just tuning that down may be helpful to patients. The other thing is the JAK-STAT axis is important for a number of receptor tyrosine kinases and a number of other cell signaling aspects in cancer that may be important, and downregulating that may be helpful. And lastly, there's probably a story related to STAT activation in sort of pivoting the inflammation versus anti-tumor immunity, although that's a very complicated story that still has to be teased out.
I guess one thing we should point out, and this certainly comes up as an issue in myelofibrosis and JAK inhibitions, which is the correlation or lack of correlation with JAK mutations. My understanding is that you actually see very few JAK mutations in pancreatic cancer.
That's true. There are almost no JAK mutations. If, however, you think a little bit more broadly around factors in the cytokine axis between the STATs, a few cytokine receptors, and so forth, you can come up with a handful of common mutations which can comprise 5 to 10% that could be considered theoretically targetable or driver mutations. However, that's not been validated in the clinic, and I'm not aware of very good cell line data either yet.
I mean, it turns out, too, even in myelofibrosis, where there are a lot of JAK mutations, that doesn't seem to be the reason that the drug works. It works regardless of mutation status and probably somehow through a similar mechanism in terms of what you found there with pancreatic cancer. Can you talk about the results of the study?
The study was a randomization of 127 patients to CAPE placebo versus CAPE Rux. So the main endpoints was overall survival. And in the intention to treat or so-called unselected population, there was a modest improvement in overall survival. The hazard ratio was 0.79 with sort of a trend p-value. But the key message was in the pre-planned subgroup analysis of patients with a high CRP, that is above the median, which in this study was 13, the hazard ratio was 0.47. The p-value was highly significant at 0.01. So that was a fairly important improvement in overall survival. Similar trends were seen in the unselected and then the high CRP groups, also related to progression-free survival. The study also looked at another inflammation score, so-called a modified Glasgow prognostic score, which is essentially two components, CRP, cut at 10, not at 13, and albumin being low or normal, and that also segregated patients into benefit. Those patients with the higher CRP and the lower albumin benefited most.
One of the most interesting things I thought about your presentation related to the weight, patients' weight gain or weight loss. Can you talk about what was seen there?
Yeah. Patients gained weight on the ruxolitinib group more than patients on the placebo, and weight gain had to be qualified for being both the sustained and not associated with fluid retention. And with that, both in the intention to treat, the high CRP, and to your comment, even in the low CRP group, the amount of weight gain was greater with ruxolitinib. The percent of patients with some degree of weight gain varied between roughly 20 and 40% in the ruxolitinib group across those different subgroups, ITT and high and low CRP, as opposed to, you know, sort of between 5 and 10% of patients would gain weight on the capecitabine placebo group.
Where are things heading with this strategy? What's being looked at right now? And where do you think we might be in a few years?
So the positive results here have launched two phase three studies. The nicknames for these are the so-called Janus 1 and Janus 2 studies. There have also been a number of studies announced in other tumors where so-called oncoinflammation may be relevant. These include breast, colon, and a number of other tumor types. I suspect, given the amount of attention now on immunity and inflammation as very linked biologies, there will probably be a lot of other strategies to try to target this axis beyond just ruxolitinib.
Yeah, actually, I think your colleague Kim Blackwell presented a paper on the issue of potentially using JAK inhibitors like ruxolitinib in triple-negative breast cancer. Do you know what's been seen there and in these other solid tumors? What do you measure to try to determine this, like C-reactive protein, or is there something else you can look at?
Yeah, so there's been a lot of very good basic biology related particularly to STAT3 in particular in different tumor types. And with a minor caveat related to literature bias and publication bias, activation of this axis has tended to be an unfavorable prognostic factor, and targeting it improves outcomes in preclinical models. One of the most important models have been in breast cancer. The drugs used, though, the devil's in the details, particularly preclinically, since you have a much larger toolkit, and there have been a number of specific STAT transcription factor inhibitors which have been used preclinically. In the clinic, I think we're just starting to sort of see JAK and potentially other cytokine strategies being used. And I'm not aware of clinical data with breast cancer yet, although it's a very rational approach.
So in terms of these phase 3 studies, this is, again, capecitabine Rux?
Correct.
And how do you see that doublet? Let's say, you know, you see similar benefits to what you just reported. Where would you see that coming in? A second-line therapy? It kind of seems like you don't have very much time. You know, maybe somehow it'd be better to get in first line. I don't know that people would do that, though. How do you see it sort of happening?
I think the first interpretation, if it was positive, would be to use it in a patient population with a regimen like the study. So that you can kind of take to the bank, so to speak. I think it would be fairly logical to extrapolate to patients who may not be appropriate for first-line chemo for the reasons we mentioned, poor performance status. There are a number of trials going on now looking at combinations of so-called first-line therapies, particularly GEM or GEM-nab-paclitaxel. But the caveat for those will be that JAK inhibitors, particularly if they hit both JAK1 and 2, will also affect hematopoiesis. So the amount of myelosuppression you could get in combination with a significantly myelosuppressive drug could be a little bit trickier. And I think there may need to be a little bit more finessing the exact dose and schedule for this ruxolitinib and probably other drugs in the class when they're combined with either gemcitabine, gem-nab-paclitaxel, or with FOLFIRINOX. And I think those studies are now going on.
And that clearly is obviously a different disease, but clearly has been the issue with myelofibrosis. I haven't heard anything, though, beyond myelosuppression in terms of qualitative side effects. Are you able to discern, or could you tell from the data, whether beyond, you know, myelosuppression there's any kind of quality life issues with JAK inhibitors?
Yeah, at the doses used here, it looked like the placebo.
So I want to spend the rest of our time talking about colorectal cancer, and particularly want to get into some of the issues in terms of management of advanced disease. But first, just to address a common question that we get from oncologists in terms of the adjuvant setting, I'm curious what your approach is right now to adjuvant therapy, particularly of stage 2 disease.
Yeah, this is one of the longest conversations I have in the clinic. I call this "what does a few percent mean to you" kind of a discussion. So the key parameters are going to be patient's interest, age, comorbidities. Age is particularly important because over age 70, the value proposition of oxaliplatin is pretty limited. The next issue will be issues related to microsatellite instability, which is uncommonly altered, but it would change management because of its generally favorable prognosis and suggesting at least that 5-FU as monotherapy is not active. Within that group of patients, after the discussions related to what does a few percent mean to you, the MSI testing, the other comorbidities, we'll occasionally try to risk stratify a bit more with a sort of genomic health risk predictor. But usually the treatment options are going to be FOLFOX, 5-FU or capecitabine, or observation only. And as much as we know, I think the issue of whether a few percent matter to the individual patient is probably the biggest parameter in trying to decide who to treat.
You mentioned the Oncotype DX for colon cancer. In what situations do you utilize that assay, and what do you think it brings to the table?
It's mostly useful for patients who would be very eager either to get treatment or to not get treatment if you could further stretch out their risk a little bit more than the tent clustering of around sort of the 10 to 15% that many stage two patients will fall into. In my practice, probably we use that test or need or get the test in probably less than a third of the patients with stage two disease, just because the other parameters usually bucket people to a comfort level in the decision-making.
What about the issue of oxaliplatin? Do you think it's useful to be more precise about prognosis in terms of making that decision?
I think these are all more related than different. And very often in the patient who you'd want to be or they want to be very aggressive, you know, the issue of toxicity from oxaliplatin, the inconvenience of putting in a port, that's usually not the biggest driver for the patient who wants to be a good candidate in the first place. It does help. But again, the number of people who almost self-sort on the other parameters tend to be a minority.
You know, this issue of what, as you say, how interested people might be in a few extra percent or just a very marginal increase in outcome, in a way, kind of reminds me of some of the work that's been done in the past in breast cancer originally. We actually did some work in colon cancer identifying the fact that there are, seems like there's a significant fraction of patients in both of those tumors that might be interested in treatment. But colon cancer is different because they have the option of capecitabine. I mean, it's something you can stop if the patient's going to have a problem. It's not going to take their hair away. What do you find when you hold out that issue of the possibility of taking capecitabine? People react. Do they react in the same way in terms of, you know, looking for either a, you know, major or minor benefit? To me, it seems like you don't have that much to lose by trying that.
The issue of capecitabine versus chemo really tends to be in for those folks who, as you sort of put it, what do you got to lose? The big issue is you don't have the neuropathy and some of the other larger toxicities from oxaliplatin, and you don't have the drama of needing to put in a port for a relatively short duration of treatment. Now, separate from that, I think once you sort of explain things to patients, I think the convenience of and what sounds like taking a pill is attractive. I think once you talk to people a bit more, I think a lot of their motivation has to do with the treatment and the overall side effect profile, not specifically whether it's a pill. But I think some of the pragmatic simplicity of being able to give an oral drug that patient needs to come back only every 3 weeks makes it a lot easier to see whether or not it's worth gearing up to start treatment. The other issue with all treatment is you really are reinvesting every cycle. So if you didn't tolerate it initially, particularly when the value proposition of the overall package is modest, and in the adjuvant setting, there are even trials now going on of 3 versus 6 months. So the conversation about how much to gear up for any level of treatment is both an issue related to starting and how much effort to put into continuing and when you can actually stop if things are not or a little bit more toxic than you'd really want to maintain lifestyle.
So let's talk about management of metastatic disease. And I know you've been involved with the ARES registry study. Another similar effort was the BRIGHT study, looking at clinical practice patterns, particularly related to bevacizumab.
I think one of the most important pieces was the fact that the patient outcomes on the BRIGHT and ARES registries were really very, very similar to the trial data. Responses, PFS, and OS really tracked fairly well with a lot of the phase 3 data. The second thing, which was, I think, very instructive for practice, is in general the outcomes for oxali and ERI, so-called FOLFOX or FOLFIRI-based regimens, look nearly identical, including the rates for discontinuation, the timing of discontinuation. And I think that's actually very encouraging because it supports flexibility for the clinician to pick whatever regimen they think is most appropriate for their patient.
Anything that we've learned in terms of predictors of who benefits more from anti-angiogenic approaches, particularly Bev?
There is no validated marker that's ready for prime time. If you look at a number of studies, particularly in renal cell, there have been two phase 3 studies which have noted that high IL-6 levels were predictive of greater benefit from bevacizumab. Our group helped do one of those studies with the CLGB90206 interferon plus or minus Bev, and Liu and Haymock and colleagues did the same type of analysis in the second-line pazopanib versus best supportive care in renal cell, and both groups found that high IL-6 were predictive of greater benefit. However, in renal cell, because there's so much benefit from VEGF inhibitors, this doesn't really tell you who not to treat. I think it does potentially provide some intriguing speculation related to the JAK-STAT hypothesis we talked about earlier as a way to sort of interpret that data, but there's nothing really ready for prime time. One thing that did come out at ASCO as a poster, there was an update to the small isoform VEGF data, and at least initially, it does not appear to be holding when they reran some of those assays as a potential predictor for bevacizumab. Now, one important caveat is the field has looked at only a limited number of candidate predictors, and there have been only a limited number of good quality phase 3 studies which have collected plasma appropriately for good analyses. So we've done a good but not yet great job of looking at predictors for VEGF inhibitors. But state of the art today, there's nothing that's ready for clinical prime time.
Another question relating to first-line therapy. Before we were talking about FOLFIRINOX, and we have FOLFOXIRI in colon cancer, and particularly the report from the TRIBE trial of FOLFOXIRI bevacizumab. And I see that you're part of an ongoing study. There was actually a poster about this at ASCO. I like the name of this trial, the STEAM study, STEAM. I don't know how they got that. Can you talk a little bit about this randomized phase 2 study comparing FOLFOXIRI Bev to FOLFOX Bev?
So this study is the U.S. follow-up to the TRIBE data. So TRIBE was FOLFIRI Bev versus FOLFOXIRI Bev, so the addition of Oxali to FOLFIRI. And those data looked very good, higher response rate, better progression-free survival, and better overall survival by front-loading the more intense chemotherapy for a limited induction period and then maintenance. This would suggest that maybe there is something, you know, if you really have a much better initial response rate, that you can coast for much longer, and also related perhaps to some of the issues related to neuropathy, reuse of oxaliplatin may be a little bit easier in some patients. At any rate, this is the American version. This is FOLFOX Bev is the control group. FOLFOXIRI, as used in TRIBE, is the experimental, and there's a second experimental group, so-called modified FOLFOXIRI, which is essentially sequential use of FOLFOX and then FOLFIRI. And this may be a way of, you know, mitigating some of the significant myelosuppression that's sometimes seen and the side effects with the whole package. That study is ongoing. It's accruing well. And at least initially, there are no unexpected side effects from the dose and schedule in a U.S. population. Given the activity in TRIBE and the frequent use of the cousin regimen of FOLFIRINOX from pancreas cancer, I think having good data on whether or not the triplet's better in colon cancer patients would be very useful, particularly for those patients who may be so-called borderline resectable, where a little bit extra response may be particularly useful.
Also, that TRIBE study, I've heard people refer to the outcomes in patients with BRAF mutations. Are there any situations right now where you will use FOLFOXIRI Bev off study, for example, in a younger patient with, you know, a lot of disease that's, say, BRAF positive?
The data from TRIBE suggested that patients who had a BRAF mutation may actually benefit fairly well from the triplet therapy. There's an important caveat that it was a relatively small number of patients. That said, I think for a young, good performance status patient who could tolerate them, I would probably consider that a slightly preferred approach. in 2014. I think I'm not convinced those data will necessarily hold as strongly as more data come in. However, for a good performance status patient, as you sort of mentioned before, what do you got to lose? Because if it is true, it would be an important regimen for that group of people.
So the last thing I want to ask you about, getting back into anti-angiogenesis, you've written about the issue of resistance to anti-angiogenesis. I'd like you to comment on that. And also, I see that you did a review paper on the drug ramucirumab, which is a different mechanism in terms of the way it works as a monoclonal antibody to the VEGFR receptor, obviously approved in gastric cancer. But I'm curious what you think about that agent and whether there's a future of that agent in colon cancer.
The mechanism of resistance to anti-VEGF therapy are still being worked out. Preclinically, there are a number of very good candidates. In the clinic, the efforts to look have focused around a number of cytokines and particularly several of the VEGF family ligands. So as we mentioned before, there was an attempt to look at the small isoforms for VEGF-A. This was the so-called small isoform assay that had some more caveats updated at ASCO this year. However, other VEGF ligands can also bind to VEGFR2, which is the predominant receptor signaling what we commonly call angiogenesis, endothelial cell proliferation, survival, migration, and so forth. The ligands VEGF C and D were traditionally thought to bind mostly to R3. R3 is thought to have a role mostly around so-called lymph angiogenesis, not angiogenesis. However, processed forms of VEGF C and D can bind and signal very well through VEGF R2, and in the tumor milieu, these ligands are processed and are abundant in their process formed and can signal. We had reported on VEGF-D being a predictive marker for bevacizumab in the CLGB80303 pancreas study. The Australian MAX study in colon cancer reported on VEGF-D by immunohistochemistry. And this in total would suggest there is something to alternate ligands C and D to be able to bypass VEGF-A as a mechanism of resistance to bevacizumab. Bevacizumab is an antibody that binds VEGF-A, so it does not bind the receptor, and it does not bind the other VEGF ligands C and D. Ramucirumab is an antibody to the VEGF R2 receptor, and it blocks all of the ligands A, C, and D, as well as B, from binding to VEGFR2, and for that reason may be able to prevent resistance being mediated by VEGF C and D. Whether or not that's actually important and clinically meaningful or distinguishes the two drugs, I think is a great question. Ramucirumab's reported its data in a couple tumor types, including gastric. The colon cancer second-line phase 3 probably will report out a little bit later this year. And if that's positive, I think the really important question will be how positive and are there any biomarker work to help us identify who should potentially get one VEGF inhibitor versus the other.
So final question, another agent that's come into the armamentarium for advanced colorectal cancer has been regorafenib. Now it's been out there a little bit. What's your experience with it, and how does it figure into your practice?
So regorafenib reported out on its so-called CORRECT study. Axel Grothy and Eric Van Cutsem were the lead authors on that. Regorafenib is a VEGF-based multikinase inhibitor. So it hits all the VEGF receptors, hits a number of other so-called angiogenic receptors as well. The magnitude of benefit from a survival point of view, the median survival was improved by under 1.5 months, so-called 1.4 months. And that's, I think, a modest benefit, maybe meaningful for some patients, particularly for patients who get more than the average benefit, that it can be useful, but unfortunately is not a dramatic result. The main issue with regorafenib, at least it appears in U.S. patients, is tolerability. The dose that was used in the correct study and is in the prescribing information at 160 milligrams per day is very challenging to tolerate for many patients. A number of strategies are being looked at to try to avoid the problems, including starting at a lower dose such as 80 or 120 instead of 160. The side effects tend to be a couple things: fatigue, LFT changes, and also hand-foot syndrome. And those can be mitigated by the dose adjustment. Interestingly, our group even reported recently on a potential treatment for the hand-foot syndrome, and we'll see if that might end up getting support to be looked at a little bit more.
What kind of treatment?
We think that it may be related to a conserved biology of the vasculature in the palms and soles, and that some of this is going to be mediated by nitric oxide. And drugs which could be applied topically that would modulate nitric oxide might be potentially useful. One of this is, ironically, would be, you know, phosphodiesterase 5 inhibitors, things like sildenafil.
Wow.
Neil, please be sure to apply appropriately.
Wow.
Again, we have only anecdotal data, and you know, I'm hopeful that we can garner support for a proper randomized study to see whether the anecdotes can be confirmed. If anybody does it and has a good response, please email me.
You're talking about taking oral sildenafil, or there's some kind of topical preparation?
No, you can apply it topically. You'd have to get either the active pharmaceutical ingredient with a compounding pharmacy or grind up the little blue pills.
Interesting thought to conclude.
Yeah, I would discourage the oral. The sort of likely dose intensity you'd get to the skin probably would not be adequate. But again, if anybody tries it and has a good response, please email me.